The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. A couple of things have changed since the last time I spoke to you. I have shut down my own personal website, which I've been around for about 7 years, and 6 or 7 years, and to be honest, I haven't really been keeping up with it. It became kind of an expensive way to showcase a lot of older pieces of mine and some of my books published by Diapara Press and then bound and sold by a company called Lulu. And I did it really because, you know, I wasn't keeping up with it, and it was kind of archaic. It was a much older style site. And the fact is that I've become so connected with the Voice of Reason and my own particular niche within a very diverse group of people, quite frankly, who do shows here, very, very different from one another, but all I think moving to the same goal. That I decided really that I'm going to shift my website, shut it down entirely, and then move a lot of my favorite pieces as well as my books to my program page, The Voice of Reason. And I want to publicly thank Mike Connor, because he's doing a lot of the legwork in terms of the transition. By the time you hear this, I'm actually recording this a day after Thanksgiving 2010. It'll be December by the time you hear this. The transition will have been complete. And so the old Rush Journal, site will no longer exist, and I will give away that domain name. And, the Voice of Reason really is a great place. It's a great place to work. And, the number of hits that we get, per week is really staggeringly large. And that really shows you the extreme dissatisfaction with the current regime that exists out there. We're allegedly on the fringes of political and social and economic thinking, and yet we the number of hits we get and downloads we get can rival any of the mainstream sites out there. So that's really one good reason to be optimistic. And I've always said that there's a lot of things going on in this world right now that should make us and keep us optimistic. And this is why the regime is so upset. You know, this is why they're trying to ban us and shut us up in any way possible. And yet, given the motley crew of people who run the so-called nationalist right or the paleo right out there, and their general incompetence in pretty much any aspect of their lives, the fact that we, in spite of them, continue to grow and continue to threaten the system, the bourgeois globalist system, should really tell you something, and really should make you smile, because we do have plenty of reasons out there to be optimistic. And the crises throughout Europe, France, Greece, of course, Ireland, Iceland last year, shows you that the alleged stability of the bourgeois West is really a fraud and a sham, and it doesn't exist. And the fact is that this may be, in fact, our time. The time to really unleash the power of the local, of the federalism, of national anarchism, of the agrarian, ethnic and religious community, and all the other different forms that protest, in a constructive sense, may take. This could be our time. I mean, protest is normally considered a negative thing when we approach and confront the system for whatever reason, but protest could also be a positive thing, where those of us who are motivated can build and create something new. And So that's not a bad message, and I do believe it's true, and I believe that we are headed to a great extent to the realization of at least some of our goals, especially at the local level, the level of the family, the level of the locality, the parish, monastery, whatever institution it is. And I think largely the Western so-called rationalist project has been exploded, both in politics and economics, and the 20th century has proven that. And so this century may well be ours to some extent. And I'm talking largely really building on the local level, the cultural level, the religious level, the ethnic level, more than anything else. And to a great extent, that's what we're all about at the Voice of Reason. Although I have a very specific and specialized niche here, it is, I think, part of a much, much larger whole, and I'm happy to be a part of it. So at the end of the month of November, everything of mine will shift over to the Voice of Reason, and they will then be the stewards of some of my work, and I very much appreciate that. Today I want to talk about Slavophilism. Slavophilism is a specific philosophical movement based overwhelmingly in Russia in the 1840s through the 1860s. Of course, the word Slavophile refers to those who love the Slavs. That's not specifically what this word means. I'm referring to it as a technical term that describes a particular philosophical movement arising in Russia during the reign of Nicholas I. And I've spent many years worrying about the mentality of the Slavophiles. To a great extent, you see parallel movements in different parts of the world. I want to include, like, Patrick Pearce in Ireland, for example, would be one of these style thinkers. You have quite a bit of it in Ukraine with the autocephalous Orthodox Church, the concept of Subbundo Pravna. And the Slavophile buzzword is similar. It's Suburnost. And in both cases, it's not talking about the rule of the council. That's a kind of a ridiculous translation. It's not about rule at all. It's about the unity of the agrarian ethnic life under a monarchy, generally speaking. Now, what we're going to deal with is a fairly substantial problem, not only in my own research, but in Russian studies in general, is a substantial split between the state that was run by Tsar Nicholas I and the state that the Slavophiles were concerned with. They were vaguely monarchists, but they envisioned the monarchy not as this Caesarist type of entity. They view the monarchy as an icon of piety. And I have actually used that phrase in my own research, and I've stepped back to a great extent from the more laudatory point of view that I had towards the post-Petrine monarchy in Russia to a more critical point of view. The pre-Petrine monarchy, I still remain a very strong supporter of, but that state was infinitely smaller and less powerful in the lives of the common person. And this is, by the way, not only one of my opinions, but an opinion of the Slavophile movement in Russia and Ukraine and even Serbia as a whole. So the Slavophiles essentially were national anarchists in the sense that they held to autonomous agrarian communes and their parallel, which was the urban artel, which is essentially a voluntary private trade union. And that this, along with the parish and monastery, were the basic economic and political sources of life in Orthodox countries. The monarchy being there essentially for self-defense and always as a living example of piety and self-sacrifice. And I want to talk about something. An article came out in 2005 called Power as Burden, the Slavophile Concept of the State by Paolo Costa. And there's a lot of garbage on the Slavophile movement out there, but this is not one of them. And it's one of the more recent offerings in the scholarship on the Slavophile movement. And particularly its relationship to the state and to the government. And so I want to use this time to kind of modify what I had written back in 2000, over a decade ago in the Third Rome, and provide a more nuanced understanding. Because, you know, I had a chapter in the Third Rome on the Slavophiles. But these days, I'm realizing that that's a problem. Because the Slavophiles overwhelmingly were ethnic religious anarchists who viewed the reign of Nicholas I as something extremely negative. Extremely negative in the sense that this was really a Western absolute bureaucratic monarchy, not the monarchy of ancient Russia. And so, including a chapter of the Slavophiles in a book like The Third Rome, is an intellectual problem, and I want to correct that intellectual problem. It's these guys were opponents of that modern Russian monarchy, supporters of the pre-Petrine or medieval Russian monarchy that came to an end with the split between Tsar Alexis and the Old Believers. The Old Believers maintained a deeply romantic concept of the Russian tradition. And I want to hold that I believe the Old Believer movement in Russia maintains the ancient integrity of the Russian state, something that is close to the Slavophile movement, and that was imitated to some extent by the Ukrainian autocephalous movement. These are all nationalist, quasi-anarchist movements that, when they deal with monarchy at all, they're dealing with a much older version. Monarchy really is a leader of the army, not the leader of the government. And government is something very local, almost apolitical, and that it derives from the basic common tradition, that context that the average citizen, especially the simple peasant, maintained internally. Now, this is something basically Dostoevsky had held to himself. And it's common among the Slavophile movement that it's really the peasantry, it's the simple people, far more than the intellectuals, that maintain the traditions of old Russia and the faith. The article by Okolstev holds that people like Leo Tolstoy also shared certain aspects of national anarchism as well as the Slavophile movement. But something that connected Tolstoy to people like Aksakov is the idea of non-political involvement. It's an ancient Christian idea, an ancient Orthodox idea. You see it in Russia, and you see it as far back as St. Augustine, that politics destroys people. That power, no matter how good your intentions are, power will destroy the people who gain it. That power will be used for the benefit of the wielder or the wielder's friends, again, no matter how good the intentions of the person. The human ego, the human psyche, is simply too weak to handle the tremendous responsibility of power and money. And the result really is that Tolstoy, the Slavophiles, even St. Augustine, hold to the view that power is terrible, that power usually does not make things better for the population as a whole, and that it, from a moral point of view, it is destructive to those who control it. And this is a common idea, and of course, this is one of the reasons why this movement was largely anarchist in inspiration. Because nobody can wield authority well, and therefore the authority has to go. Now, there's a slightly more moderate view that you see in people like Komiukov and Kedivsky in the 1840s and 50s in Russia. The idea that because power is a terrible burden, this isn't something that you should want. Power is a terrible thing. Power is crushing. You see this in the writings of Marcus Aurelius, for example, the Roman Empire. Power is a terror. If you're sensitive and truly moral, power is about the last thing you should want. Lots and lots of money is the last thing you should want, because this is what harms people. This is what destroys people. And so one of the great things about the Russian peasant in Aksakov's writings and in Tolstoy's writings is that they are generally apolitical. They don't demand power at the federal level. They do want to see their interests maintained at the local level, however, and that's why the commune is so important. But here's the thing. In the Slavophile mentality, you have the more moderate point of view that the czar, the monarch, sacrificially takes the burden of power on himself. Tsar Nicholas II always claimed that the burden of monarchy, especially in a country the size of Russia, was absolutely crushing and would crush anybody. And the Tsar became, in the mind of the Slavophiles, an unfortunate. He was unfortunate because he had the entire weight of the state on his shoulders. Tolstoy and the Slavophiles held to the view that people were harmed by politics. Tolstoy's argument went like this. The state is about power. Power is about violence, or at least the threat of violence. Not all laws, really, if they're not backed by the threat of force, they're not really laws, at least in the political realm. But if you take that to its conclusion, you've established the principle that laws, even good laws, are based on force to one extent or another. And therefore, in our own personal lives, force and violence are legitimate, especially if we believe ourselves to be in the right. True law is based on violence. Goodness and the virtue that comes from good law is based on violence. And therefore, even the virtuous person can use this kind of violence and force if he thinks that he's in the right. And society cannot be based on this. In other words, politics makes violence or the threat of violence acceptable in life. Not only acceptable, but virtuous. Now, Tolstoy will go further. Tolstoy will say that the czar and the bureaucracy should be dismantled. The law emanating from St. Petersburg should be dismantled. And even though there will be acts of violence perpetrated in society because of the lack of law, that will be far less total violence in society, since violence and its threat are not institutionalized anymore. It will become the exception rather than the rule. But if you're opposed to violence in society and you want peace and unity in society, then the last thing that you could want, in Tolstoy's argument, is an institution like the bureaucracy and the police and the czardom that is based on violence or the threat of violence. Violence that exists in society is going to happen whether the state exists or not. The big difference in this case is that when you remove the state and that kind of bureaucratic power, and let's be clear, by the way, I want to make it clear that when I talk about monarchy, I am not talking about the bureaucracy that allegedly does the monarch's wishes. I'm talking about the monarch as a person with all of that moral influence. The bureaucracy and the army and the police, that's a different story. Theoretically, it's under the control of the monarch, but in practical terms, it is not. In practical terms, it's under the control of major bureaucratic functionaries and military men. But we could speak very generally and refer to the state as everything from the czar on down to the local policeman. So let's use that definition here. Violence exists in society no matter what the state does. Even totalitarian states have violence in society. But violence at the private level is nothing compared to what the megastate does on a regular basis. So even if you hold that there'll be a lot of acts of violence if the state no longer exists, it's still, in toto, far less actual violence in society. The state is institutionalized violence. It doesn't stop violence. In fact, it is a force for violence. Now, this is Tolstoy's argument. Of course, Tolstoy was an anarchist, a Christian of a very eccentric sort, and an agrarian. So, to some extent, he parallels the argument of the Slavophiles, who hold to the commune as really the only legitimate authority in society. And the monarchy, if it is to exist at all, needs to exist as an icon, as a living icon of tradition, authority, and piety. No, I said authority. I want to separate authority from power. You can have a great degree of moral authority without having any power whatsoever. Power is about violence and coercion. Authority is something different. And even the most radical anarchist does not reject the concept of authority. Jesus Christ had tremendous authority. But on earth, he had absolutely no power whatsoever. Christ was the ultimate expression of this schism between power and authority. Tolstoy and the Slavophiles want to say that power is a terrible thing. The Slavophiles may grudgingly say that it may be necessary in some cases, but it always is wielded in a way that's harmful to the wielder. By the way, it's also an old Platonic argument that the person who does injustice hurts the people who are wronged, but the person that's hurt the most is the doer of the unjust act, because this person is now slowly but surely being habituated into a life of injustice. And part of that process is these constant rationalizations that the unjust person has to constantly come up with. So over time, the unjust person becomes a moral disaster area, living in a world totally based on lies. These lies are his own self-justification. And if you want to see a very powerful fictional expression of this, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment is absolutely central. And it has to do, speaking very generally, it has to do with the idea of committing injustice. And that commission of injustice, doing more harm to the criminal than it could ever do to society. This is the problem of power. The Slavophile view is, in short, that the Tsar is a martyr by the very fact that he's Tsar. The Tsar is a martyr because he has now taken all political power to himself. If power is a bad thing, then you have one of two options. Either you eliminate all sources of power, which may in fact be impossible because you have to have power to eliminate power, and then voluntarily give it up. So that's an iffy issue. Or concentrate power in a central institution so much that really one person or group of people are the only ones unlucky enough to be able to wield it. I mean, we might say that, oh, the Tsar, you know, he ate whatever food he wanted, he was wealthy, he had all of this, you know, fawning servitors and everything else, and yet the Slavophiles and St. Augustine will remind you that, you know, chances are the Tsar is probably the most unhappy person in all of Russia because he has the crushing burden of power over people to deal with every day of his life. And if you read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, you'll see a very good example of what this is like and how miserable good rulers really are. Anyway, let that serve as an introduction to this topic. I want to get deeper into it, but we're going to go to a break now. And when we come back, we'll continue on this topic. So hang in there. I'll talk to you in a minute.
go away because there's more to come on The Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to The Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to this particular edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. We are talking about the Slavophile movement in Russia, roughly between the 1840s and the 1860s, and even more than that, the intellectual pedigree of the movement and the successors, really the intellectual tradition of the Slavophile movement. And I want to say, I've said before, that one of the hallmarks of this understanding is a radical schism between the concepts of authority and power. When Christ was on earth, he was offered all the kingdoms of the world by Satan to rule over in exchange, and as a result, he should then bow to Satan in worship and in thanks. And of course, Christ rejected it. That should strike you. That story strikes a lot of people because it suggests that Satan actually controlled these cities and therefore had the power to give them to Christ. That's the implication, anyway. Just as significant is the idea that Christ turned it down. Christ did not have any power whatsoever on earth. Last 3 years of his life, in his public work, he didn't have a home. He was quite literally homeless. He had a small group of followers. The Pharisees, of course, were his most bitter enemies. And he condemned the Pharisees as the tools of Satan. In fact, he said this over and over again, and that he was going to reconstitute Israel in his own person. Israel in the true, not in the false, sense of the word. But from the Slavophile point of view, from the point of view of Subornost and Subornopravna, it's authority that matters. One of the great Slavophiles in the 1840s, Alexei Homiakov, says that the church, like its founder Christ, is not a power in society. It is a manifestation of the truth, and as a result, is an authority in society. It should not ever be a power in society, simply based on the idea that power destroys people, and Christ came, among other things, to show how destructive power is. The fact that Satan had control of all the world's kingdoms, such that he was able to offer them to Christ, strongly suggests what a lot of the Slavophiles truly believed, that in order to gain power in society, you have to make some kind of a deal. Whether that deal is virtue or your soul, it's a deal you have to make with those powers who own the kingdoms of the world. Both Tolstoy and the Slavophile movement, and Tolstoy was very impressed by the Slavophiles. He viewed himself as a Slavophile, although the Slavophiles were generally very orthodox in their religion, but Tolstoy was not. Tolstoy, if anything, was very much impressed with the old believers who truly maintained the ancient view of Sobornos. And one of the things that proves that Sobornos really was a part of old Russia is the old believer movement. Now, the old believer movement separated from mainstream Russian life in the latter half of the 17th century under the reign of Tsar Alexis, and therefore took the mentality of that era and then separated from society and maintained that mentality regardless of what else was going on in Russian life. Therefore, the old believer communities, which still exist in the Caucasus and in Siberia today, are living icons. They're living relics of old Russia. Stepping into their communities is, in fact, stepping back in time. And it was illegal to speak in favor of the old believers in Russia. And this may have something to do with why the Slavophiles really didn't press the issue all that much, although Tolstoy did much later on. But the old believers truly maintained that much older concept of the rule of spiritual, religious unanimity that maintained their communities. The Slavophiles and Tolstoy looked very much askance at Western Europe, and they looked at Western Europe negatively because what they saw, and this is, by the way, something central to the Slavophile way of thinking, what they saw was violence sublimated to capitalist relations and the court system. So, if you were to crush your opponent in capitalist competition and put him out of business, maybe even destroy him, take your opponent to court and destroy him that way, that isn't really civility. That's simply using the law to destroy somebody. And of course, maybe centuries ago, you would have just been able to kill him. You can't do that anymore in civilized society. So you do the next best thing, and you destroy him and his life in court or in competition. So the Slavophiles look to Western Europe as a, and they're looking, you know, this is the middle of the 18th century. What they see is a smug, bureaucratic, middle-class, bourgeois mentality that destroys their competition, puts thousands of people out of work. They're ruled by the banks, and they call this civilization. Of course, the Slavophiles and Tolstoy had it right. This is just sublimated violence. The fact that they could institutionalize it and channel it in these ways doesn't change the fact that people are destroyed in this system. And they look at Russian westernizers like Belinsky and say, how dare you think that this is something that should work in Eastern Europe and Russia? We have a different destiny, and we have a destiny where we could show Western Europeans that you could still live a modern life without succumbing to these horrible temptations. Most of all, the temptation of power. Because even the most virtuous capitalist wants to crush his competition. Even the most virtuous capitalist will use the court system to harm his competition and those who wish to harm him. It isn't a society. It's, in fact, a social contract that sublimates violence and institutionalizes them in these mechanisms. The Slavophile movement held that one of the worst aspects of this sublimated violence is in republicanism. The theory of republican rule is both for Komiakov and Kadivsky, suited to people who hold material goods and material power to be the best things in life, the only things worth living for. That the republican system exists to protect the oligarchy. And you heard on this show, I spoke about the Renaissance in Italy and how that was explicitly the case. in the Italian city-states, at least in the northern part of the country, that the Italian city-states were republics because it was the oligarchy who had apportioned state power to themselves, no different than you would apportion stocks to stockholders in a firm. And that Western absolutism in France in particular was simply an extension of this same idea. These guys hold that political power is never a right, but it is an obligation. And the Tsar, or really any monarch, takes power upon himself as a burden, a sacrifice. And ultimately, especially in Tolstoy's way of thinking, it's the struggle against wealth and power that is part of a broader ascetic mission. Another article came out in 2009 called The Slavophile Lexicon of Personality by Albert Alushin, and it actually is another, almost a rehabilitation of the Slavophile mentality. Back in the 20th century, 60s, 70s, 80s, it was fashionable to beat them up. But I think the fall of the Soviet Union has permitted a lot of newer ideas about the 19th century, so important to the modern world, it gave them a new lease on life. Let's put it this way. Alushin splits the Slavophile mentality into its views dealing with the Western world, France, Germany, Britain, etc., and the Orthodox world. They view the Western world as based on personal autonomy, personal selfishness, this constant desire for gain, and they're very deeply divided people. Their psyche is divided. There's a civic psyche, there's a religious psyche, there's an economic psyche, there's a family psyche, and they lack integrity. For this reason, this is something stereotypical about the Western capitalist world in the middle of the 19th century, the height of industrialization. On the other hand, the Orthodox vision is one of communal living based on the silencing of the ego, or, to put it in a positive way, that the ego becomes the collective, the person becomes the collective, not the individual. Now, the Slavophiles hold the view that philosophical systems and ethical systems, they reflect the reality of the people who have created it. It's not merely the individual writer who writes down systemic philosophy or economics. This is really the entire society being crystallized in the pen of the writer. That philosophy in the Slavophile worldview cannot be separated from the society within which it is written. And the Slavophile view is that peace can only be maintained when selfhood is overcome. Selfhood is the same thing as self-willing. The Slavophiles hold fundamentally that the human personality is not autonomous by its nature, it's communal by its nature. The individual, in the sense of the individual willing ego, is a mutation. It's something radically, it's a chimera, it's radically unnatural. And they define the concept of faith, not as some sort of blind assent to something, but faith to them is the consciousness of the closeness of divinity to the person. Or even better, to the collective, to the local community, which in Russia, of course, was the commune. The mere existence of a social contract is the very opposite of this concept of faith, this concept of what the human personality really is. The social contract is a means, as I said before, to legitimize and express the violent nature of fallen, sinful humanity. But the personality is totally different from that selfish ego, Personality and ego are, in fact, opposites. And a true personality is not individual. A true personality partakes of the social whole and takes its center from it. Ultimately, egocentric societies aren't really societies at all. It is simply a chaotic clash of interest that ultimately means those with the most money and power automatically win. And therefore, it's in their interest to construct a society or to justify a society, which is little more than clashing egos. Freedom is a concept that exists amongst the Slavophiles. But it doesn't mean, and it never refers to arbitrariness. The personality cannot come from selfhood. It comes from the community. And more than that, it comes from a historically conditioned community, concentrated in a specific place, that has a very strong sense of its own tradition. In a spiritual, economic, and political sense. It is that unanimity that rules. But its presence in the community is the presence of truth. It's the presence of authority, not necessarily power. I mean, even in concept like private property. In the West, private property, at least amongst the wealthy and powerful, was something that was almost sacred in its absoluteness. The Slavophiles contrast the old Russian idea preserved in the old believer communities that ownership in the commune is based not on your mere individuality, the fact that you breathe. It's based on your level of social integration and action and activity within the communal structure. Now, talking about power, we've made the split between power and authority, that really the center of what we're talking about tonight. They look at the different means whereby power is wielded, especially in Western societies. I mean, they see it in Russia really as a result of the perversion of Peter the Great importing Western absolutist standards to foreign territory and thereby invading and overtaxing the life of the Russian people. The Orthodox people specifically. And so Peter the Great is a watershed for Russia, although in a very, very negative way. They look at how power is used in parliaments and republican regimes in the West. And they notice, and it's something that's come up on this show before, that when this kind of power is controlled by the bourgeoisie, those with property and money and influence, it usually is connected to legislative institutions, republican systems, whether it be parliamentary or oligarchic like in Florence. Either way, they are fronts for economic power. A parliamentary majority is not responsible for what it does. One of the weaknesses of monarchy, although through no fault of its own, is that you could always blame the monarch for everything. It's a lot harder to blame a parliamentary majority, a parliamentary faction. When you concentrate blame on one person, you have a perfect scapegoat. But something along the lines of a parliamentary majority, that's much stranger, I would say. And really, it's much more abstract. It's just a stranger idea. You really can't pinpoint the existence of a parliamentary majority, partially because it's always changing. And therefore, that, among other things, is how the bourgeoisie rule without responsibility. And that's really what parliaments are. No matter what kind of parliamentary system you have, they're fronts for economic authority, and politicians end up taking the fall for the economic interests, who are always in the background and usually anonymous. And so the Slavophiles are looking at Europe. They're looking at the slow integration of European life, Western European life, trade amongst the major powers. And they see this constant sublimation of violence, Of course, it's going to break out into real violence in World War I, although these men, of course, didn't live to see it. But a lot of them did predict it, by the way, that the sublimated violence will become real violence, although I doubt that anyone could have predicted the bloodbath of World War I. But they also saw this trade amongst Western European powers as destroying their cultural particularity. The bourgeoisie care only about money. They'll use nationalism if it suits them. But it's just one more way of wielding power. They don't really care one way or the other. The foundational idea here is for the nation as a unit to exist in the center, the heart of the individual. That the nation is the alienated individual. The individual is the alienated nation. The result, really the purpose of any politics, is to bridge that gap. To rule not by power, but by authority. There's something vaguely Platonic here about that. To reunite the individual to the nation, or the social and spiritual collective, is really the entire point of politics, so-called, in the Slavophile world. For them, the concept of an organic society was a society that was totally common. That there was a single spiritual entity that existed and bound it together, and as a result controlled the excessive divisions of class and access to property and power. So you have here a strong sense of national anarchism. You have a sense that the ethnic and religious element should exist in a community as an authority, as a truth that is to be obeyed because it's the truth, not because it has any power to coerce you. Christ manifested this mentality, and he manifested it explicitly when he rebuked Satan, when he offered Christ all the kingdoms of the world. If anything, that's sort of the almost the orthodox politics right there. And it was not lost on the church fathers. It was not lost on people like Saint Augustine, who then looked at politics and this drive for political power to be one of the most unhealthy you can imagine. And in modern times, we would say that revolutions destroy themselves because revolutionaries use rhetoric and force to gain power. Once they gain power, they use the state and the society for their own interests, essentially as one great wealth transfer from the society to the party. And this really is the very basis of the USSR. This kind of mentality was predicted by both the Slavophiles and the occasional Slavophile, Leo Tolstoy. They see something that Dostoevsky in the 1860s and the 1870s and 80s was to see. The West is slowly destroying itself through determinism, through materialism, through production for production's sake. And these guys revolted against these very abstract economic forces that ruled the West, and they revolted against that in favor of the virtuous individual within the Christian and Orthodox community. And so this is really something that I just kind of gave you guys a very, you know, kind of a thumbnail sketch of this, of what this mentality is and how radically different for the most part, it was from Western political thinking at the time. And the destruction that people like Machiavelli and Hobbes, were able to wreak upon, Western societies and Western concepts of justice. And, I think part of what we do here, part of our struggle here as people, as individuals, as nationalists, and I think that's one thing that we all have in common, We believe in this kind of communal autonomy based on our spiritual distinctiveness. We might differ on which particular ethnicity we're interested in, although we could differ in a very civilized way. Some are more religious, some are more racial, some are more even continental in scope, although I think that's a problem. The point is the dominance of culture, the dominance of the spiritual sources of solidarity. And that's what I'm all about, and I think a lot of people on this network, listeners as well as hosts, are all about this too. So I will conclude this now, and I will thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Tuned in to Radio Area.